It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Over a span of about 30 years, gay marriage went from being supported by less than 12% of Americans to being the law of the land. We turn to a sociologist to consider how, in the space of a single generation, American views changed on the institution of marriage. We also talk about how social change happens and what we can learn from this case. How did you see attitudes about gay marriage change over time? What do you make of the generational change that you see when you consider the LGBTQ plus movement? And what do you think we can learn from this movement about other social change? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Peter Hart Brinson is Associate Professor of Sociology and Communication and Journalism at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. He is also author of The Gay Marriage Generation, How the LGBTQ Movement Transformed American Culture. Peter, welcome to The Morning Show.
Thanks very much for having me.
I want to start with a snapshot in time that you use in your book. It's June 26, 2015. The Supreme Court has ruled 5-4 that same-sex couples are protected under the 14th Amendment and cannot be denied the right to marry. The change has the support of a sitting president, and supporters celebrate even as opponents consider this a symbol of a lost moral compass. For you, this was a symbol of how dramatically the U.S. has changed and changed quickly. Tell us why.
A study came out not too long ago that showed that the rise in public opinion about gay marriage was literally unprecedented. No issue has ever changed so much so quickly. It was ultimately about a generational change in how young Americans thought about homosexuality. And it was a change that began way back in the late 1980s. And over the course of the 1990s and 2000s, slowly worked its way through the electorate and caused public opinion to shift as it went.
Well, let's talk about how gay marriage became accepted in just a few decades. Who should get credit for this change?
It's hard to assign credit or blame, if you will. The roots of the change go way back to the LGBTQ movement in 1987 and 1988, who were reacting to a series of negative changes that affected the community. One, of course, was the AIDS epidemic. The other was a Supreme Court ruling, Bowers versus Hardwick, which upheld the state's rights to criminally prosecute individuals for the wrong kind of sexual behavior. In response to those two events, the activists in the movement launched a campaign to change the ways that Americans think and talk about sexuality. And by 1992 or so, these different groups and different activists had been largely successful in persuading the media and the Democratic Party to talk about lesbians and gays as an identity rather than as a behavior. So Americans who came of age prior to 1987 or so grew up in a society where everyone talked about sexuality as behavior. It's something that you do. By contrast, young adults who reached adulthood after 1992, roughly after President Bill Clinton's election, came of age thinking of homosexuality as a behavior. I'm sorry, as an identity, sort of like race. So it's who you are, not what you do.
And how did that change take place?
There were a series of influential events between 1987 and 1992. One set of events concerned with what groups like the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation and ACT UP were doing. These organizations targeted news organizations and popular culture to get them to change the way, the terms in which they talked about homosexuality. Through coverage of the AIDS crisis, the news media learned that the gay community was a much more multidimensional community than the simple stereotypes would have suggested. And the mass media began to portray homosexuality as if it was a normal identity equal to heterosexuality. And, of course, many today will think, well, of course it is. But prior to that point, lesbians and gays who were represented in the media were portrayed as deviants, outcasts, and tragic figures. It was really around 1993 that we saw the rise of the quote-unquote normal gay character, where they were leading characters, side characters, neighbors, family members, friends, bosses, co-workers. They were just like straight Americans, just gay.
We have already have some phone calls coming in. 800-642-1234. You can join the discussion as well. Tom is with us from Port Wing. Tom, good morning. Thanks for joining us on the morning show.
Well, good morning to you. Yeah, I would like to challenge your guest's idea that attitudes have changed. They really haven't changed. 32 out of 34 states voted against gay marriage, and most of the opposition has simply been driven underground, even amongst liberal Democrats and young people. There is a rolling of the eyes. There's this tacit acceptance. But it is attitudes really haven't changed. It's just that it's not fashionable to be anti-gay. And nobody wants to take up and bury the flag on that particular hill as they have with the issue of abortion. But it's still there. And I really want to challenge your guest thinking that somehow in less than a few years since the Supreme Court forced it down the American people's throat, that we've all of a sudden decided, hey, it's a good thing. People really haven't. They just don't publicly state what they inwardly feel.
Tom, thanks for that call. Peter?
It is certainly true that a lot of Americans have not changed their minds about this issue. There are two different kinds of change, though, that are wrapped up in the change in public opinion. One type of change is the question that Tom is mentioning, whether or not people have changed their minds. The other type of change is a change of generational replacement. And this type of change is something that's very different. And this is one of the key forces that caused public opinion as a whole to change over the years. So generational change involves older Americans who have older worldviews and older beliefs. And by older worldviews, I mean beliefs and attitudes that were formed during an earlier period of American history. These Americans died and were replaced in the population, or replaced in the electorate, if you want to think of it that way, by younger Americans who reached adulthood in a different society. And so these younger Americans grew up, specifically the ones growing up in the 1990s, thinking about homosexuality in fundamentally different terms than older Americans did. And so as older Americans died off, those Americans who defined or understood homosexuality to be a behavior, as they died off, their beliefs died with them. And they were replaced in the electorate by people who held different beliefs and different attitudes about what sexuality is for us.
Peter Hart Brinson stays with us as our program continues. He's an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire and the author of The Gay Marriage Generation, How the LGBTQ Movement Transformed American Culture. I'm John Munson. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Over the span of about three decades, gay marriage went from being supported by less than 12% of Americans to being the law of the land. We're talking with a sociologist to consider how, in the space of a single generation, Americans' views changed on the institution of marriage. We're also talking about how social change happens and what we can learn from this particular example. How did you see attitudes about gay marriage change over time? Or don't you think they have? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. My guest is Peter Hart Brinson, author of The Gay Marriage Generation, How the LGBTQ Movement Transformed American Culture. We didn't do something I normally like to do right at the top of the discussion. Let's define some terms here. When we use the term generation, what do we mean?
This generation can be a very confusing word because there's two very closely related meanings. Strictly speaking, a generation refers to generations within the family, so the relations between children, parents, and grandparents. But there's a broader meaning of generations that refers to what social scientists called cohorts. And a cohort simply refers to any group of people who goes through an event at the same time. Most people would be familiar with the idea of a birth cohort, that is everyone born during a certain year, or your high school graduating class. This book is all about generation in that sense of the term, how one group of people who grew up in one period of American society thought about homosexuality and gay marriage differently than a different generation.
So what are the signs that generational change is present or a factor in something happening in our culture?
The signs can come from almost anywhere, and that's one of the really interesting challenges of studying generational change. Generational change can manifest itself in how people talk. It can show up in people's behaviors. It can show up in the music people like, the ways people dress, how people vote. And so it's oftentimes difficult to determine what kinds of changes that we see in society are due to a generational change versus what kinds of things are due to other sorts of changes.
Let's take another call here. Jesse is with us in Green Bay. Jesse, good morning. Thanks for joining us on The Morning Show.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for having this conversation. I'm not certain if it's just for me personally with my family or if this is kind of a general kind of consensus, but I grew up in the Catholic Church. I went to Catholic schools. And as I started hitting my teenage years and questioning my own opinions and my own morals, at the same time, the Catholic Church hit their turmoil and all of the things that kind of shook the foundation of the Catholic Church. And it made me start questioning, you know, who gets to define what's moral and who gets to define what, and question that, okay, maybe homosexuality isn't a sin and maybe they aren't going to hell. And it really, like, allowed my personal opinions to change and develop into what I wanted. And I'm just wondering if that was kind of a general population thing, you know, when all that turmoil happens and people start going, okay, maybe we get to reframe what it means to be moral, not this foundation or institution.
Jesse, thanks for that. Thanks for that insight. And let's take Deb's call from Cottage Grove, because I think these are related, and then we can talk about that. Deb, thanks for joining us on The Morning Show.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to make a similar comment about the church's role, I guess, and my attitudes as well. I go to a more progressive church, and they're an open and affirming church. And basically, we just, you know, speak about gay people as it's all about love. So it's, you know, their love is the same as any other heterosexual love. So I think it's also about the people that, you know, you surround yourself with, too, and, you know, getting to know people a little bit and knowing that they're, you know, everyone is the same, and you know, it's, you know, you approach love of each other the same.
Deb, thanks. Thanks for that. Peter, one of the things you cite in your book, you talk about the research, public opinion research, and one of the questions was, I think, whether homosexuality was a sin or not. These two callers seem to kind of fit in with that. Talk a little bit about the public opinion research that that you cite in the book and how that shifted over time.
Sure thing. The single largest predictor of a person's opinion about same-sex marriage is whether or not they believe homosexuality is immoral or not. And over time, those attitudes changed right along with the attitudes about same-sex marriage. Whether or not the scandal in the Catholic Church may have caused people's views to change, and what some of the other sources of change might have been, scholars are still debating that right now. So we don't know for sure. What I can tell you is that when I did interviews with older generation and younger generation in Northern Illinois for this book, I heard stories very much like both those of the callers just now. Many people had a variety of different experiences with religion and a variety of different religious beliefs that led them over time to change their minds about the extent to which homosexuality is a sin and whether or not same-sex marriage is something that is morally supported. People continue to seek out religious guidance and spiritual guidance on their opinions about this issue, and it happens on both sides, whether you're supportive or opposed.
Let's take another call. This time we'll go to Joe in Waukesha. Joe, hello. Welcome to the morning show.
Hi, how are you? I guess what your guest noted, I think, has a central meaning, I think, on this. What, in other words, that the change is not what you do, but who you are. In other words, people who began to come out of the, you know, within families, friends, so an uncle who you know very well, an aunt, a brother, a sister, even a parent, decide to come out and say, well, this is who I am, where you may have had this one notion of homosexuality or LGBTQ people as what they do, you begin to see this is who these people who are who I love. How could I be prejudiced against people if, people I've known all my life, you know, family, friends, people I'm close to, I share with, and that has made, you know, major changes, I think, as more and more, as I said, LGBTQ people come out of the closet and has changed the views of people they know.
Joe, thanks so much for that insight. Peter?
Joe's story is the most common story I heard about the reasons that older Americans changed their mind. And it also gets to exactly what change happened during the 1990s that started this long sort of upward march of public support for same-sex marriage. On the one hand, you had more and more lesbians and gays coming out to their friends and their family and neighbors and coworkers, and people got to know them in the manner that Joe described. Even for Americans who didn't have gay friends or family members, though, they started to see representations of lesbians and gays on primetime television. Viewers may remember Ellen's coming out in 1997. It was a big TV event at the time. And in 1998, Will and Grace debuted, which was the first television show that began with a leading gay character. Even for Americans who didn't have gay friends, they sort of got to know gay characters as if they were friends or family members.
What can we learn about the role of generational change in social movements from what happened with gay marriage?
We might imagine generational change happening in a number of ways today. The movement that arose from the Parkland school shooting this past year, the current controversies surrounding the Me Too movement or Black Lives Matter. Regardless of how older Americans are responding to those events, we know that young people are reacting to them in a different way, and in a way that's probably going to be more enduring than the ways that older adults react. What's responsible for generational change ultimately is that some historical event triggers something in the minds of young people in their formative years, and those formative experiences have a way of shaping people's worldviews almost for life. It's not that they don't change when they get older, but they tend to be relatively enduring. And so young people growing up during this era are going to think a little bit differently about politics as a result of what's happening, and we may not see the effects of those changes for another decade or two.
Peter Hart Brinson, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much.
Peter Hart Brinson is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire and the author of The Gay Marriage Generation, How the LGBTQ Movement Transformed American Culture. Coming up next, the rate of pay for private attorneys in Wisconsin who take on public defender cases is $40 per hour, and that's the lowest in the nation. As a result, fewer lawyers are accepting public defender cases, especially in more rural parts of Wisconsin. We talked to the state's public defender about efforts to boost the pay for these attorneys. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. At $40 per hour, the rate of pay for private attorneys in Wisconsin who take on public defense cases is the lowest in the United States. As a result, fewer lawyers are accepting public defender cases, especially in more rural parts of the state. In this portion of the Morning Show, we talk to the state's public defender about efforts to boost the pay for these attorneys, including a recent resolution in Chippewa County aimed at raising the rate of pay to $100 per hour. How do you feel about the rate of pay for private attorneys in Wisconsin taking public defense cases? $40 an hour inadequate in your view? Maybe you're an attorney. What are your thoughts here? Will you or won't you take on public defender cases at this rate? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email address ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Kelly Thompson is Wisconsin's state public defender. Kelly, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So, first of all, explain how the public defender system works in the state of Wisconsin.
Certainly. So, Wisconsin has a statewide public defense system, and we have attorneys, staff attorneys, throughout the state. We don't have offices in all 72 counties, but we have staff that represent in all 72 counties. So, in certain parts of the state, based on location, a number of our attorneys travel a fair distance to get to the courthouses to represent clients and to be involved in the criminal justice system. We have a number of conflict cases and what we call overflow cases. Oftentimes, if we have a vacancy or because of a workload issue, we need to involve private attorneys who are willing to take public defender cases in our system. So those conflict cases and those overflow cases are then handled by private attorneys who are certified to take public defender cases, and they are paid at the low, low rate of $40 an hour that you were speaking of.
So how much demand is there for public defenders in Wisconsin?
Significant. There is no doubt about it. We're pretty good on hiring staff attorneys. We have a robust program, and we're able to get attorneys to become staff attorneys. But, well, there's twofold. So because of the pay, oftentimes as soon as the economy becomes grows and becomes better, we lose those attorneys to the private sector because of the rate of pay. But our really significant issue right now is what you were talking about, are those attorneys willing to take the conflict cases. We are struggling mightily to get attorneys to represent in our cases because of the low pay. And in certain parts of the state, and in very rural parts of the state, we just have a overall lack of attorneys. So attorneys that in areas where there was a time when there were more attorneys, they are no longer A, taking our cases, and B, even residing in those counties. So we have counties in rural parts of Wisconsin that have zero attorneys willing to take our cases. So that forces us to go out of county and sometimes several counties over, which can cause a whole host of issues in the criminal justice system.
So you have attorneys who might have to travel, what, 100 or more miles each way to handle one of these cases? And when they do handle them, they're only getting $40 an hour. That's where this big, one of the reasons that we have this big gap, this shortage in public defenders?
We're making over 400 phone calls, and sometimes in just one case. We're pulling, I know our Wausau staff is calling attorneys down in Kenosha. Up in Bayfield, we're asking attorneys from Madison to come up there. And that, while we are very appreciative, those attorneys are willing to travel, and they're doing this to help us out and help out individuals who are oftentimes incarcerated and just waiting to have their cases heard. It's not efficient and it's not effective. They do a great job, but they can't get there if there's an issue or a problem very, very readily. Sometimes what happens in those cases, oftentimes the courts have to delay their hearings. They have our clients sit in custody longer than perhaps they should be. And everybody's very cognizant of this. The judges, I know they struggle with this. The prosecutors struggle with it. And of course, our staff struggle the most with this. But it is not an efficient way for us to have attorneys traveling hundreds of miles for just a handful of cases. Is difficult. And again, these are attorneys that are willing to take cases locally. So you'll have an attorney down in Milwaukee or Kenosha or Racine that'll have clients there, and then they're rushing up to Marathon County and then perhaps over to Lincoln County. And it is not an efficient way to run our criminal justice system.
Well, and I would also speculate, probably a dangerous thing for me to be doing here, but I would also speculate that these attorneys who are coming from 5-6 hours away aren't as familiar with the local conditions and the local culture, the local version of the legal system as local attorneys would be, and that could also be to the detriment of the defendant, couldn't it?
It certainly could be. I will say I think local court systems are so happy to have attorneys showing up for these cases that they will be very, very helpful to the new attorneys. But they're always, like you said, there are nuances that you may not be familiar with and issues going on and, you know, programming. And everybody's there to help everyone out. So it's not like they'll leave people without that kind of knowledge. But as you said, there's just those basic pieces of information that that can be helpful. And again, a lot of it's the more nuanced type of information. There's no doubt about that.
So $40 an hour, we said it's the lowest rate in the nation. How far below the next, the average rate of pay across the country is Wisconsin's rate?
That's a good question. It varies because of the different systems out there. Wisconsin has been at $40 an hour now since 1995. So I think we could go more on averages. Usually the average is closer to $65, $70 an hour nationwide. This county now is, they pay, so the Supreme Court has been hearing this issue and they have been great partners in talking about and advocating the need for this rate to raise, but they are looking in the future of raising county appointments for attorneys up to $100 just to meet the need. We have federal public defender cases that I believe pay somewhere between $120 and $140 an hour. So $40 is significantly low. And the fact that it has not been raised since 1995 is a significant issue for us.
And let's compare that rate to what that same attorney would make in a private case.
Oh, you know, that those averages vary. They can vary. It could be a flat fee. It could be all the way up to hundreds of dollars an hour. We're so significantly less. We're not even in the ballpark anymore. And there are a fair number of attorneys, I will say, statewide, that used to take our cases, and they would call this, I mean, somewhat at pro bono level, because what they could get for private pay was so much significantly higher, and they're not even taking these cases anymore because they're not coming anywhere near to even reaching their overhead costs.
Well, that brings us up to this week. The Chippewa County Board unanimously passed a resolution that would urge the state legislature to increase the rates for public defenders to $100 an hour by 2020. That step in the right direction?
Absolutely. And the counties have been such wonderful partners in this because they have their own appointments that they have to make for certain types of cases outside of our purview. And what's happening is if we can't find attorneys, individuals are sitting in custody, and judges will make, if they are absolutely have to, county appointments, and it's significantly higher. And that burden is then shifted to the counties when it's my responsibility, the state responsibility. And so the counties have been terrific partners. No one wants to see somebody sitting in custody who shouldn't be, and certainly nobody wants to see someone who should be represented not getting the representation that they need. And they recognize, because we've been working so closely with the justice system, and again, this is the local judges, the court staff, and the counties, the work and the involvement, the workload it's taking to just find sometimes one attorney to take a case. And at some point in time, there's not much more that we can call every attorney on our list. And when they say no, we start over again. But especially for conflict cases, we must find private counsel. So the county boards, I will say, in these resolutions, it's organic, it's happening at the local level, and they're recognizing the need in their county. That's been wonderful support.
This isn't a new issue. You mentioned the rate hasn't changed since the 90s. Why do you think there hasn't been traction for this issue?
I think priorities. I think people are, you know, we've had a lot of support in our criminal justice system, and I think it's bipartisan support. I think people recognize the presumption of innocence. I think people recognize the value of having a strong public defense system. But this is an issue that it's not as if we go in and people say we're against it. I think it's where it falls as a priority, and I think this priority level has accelerated. I think people are hearing about it, not just from me and not just from the public defender's office. I think they're hearing about it at their local levels. I think they're hearing about it from their judges. I think they're hearing about it from the counties. You know, now that we have 19 of these county board resolutions now throughout the state, and many more looking at it. And I think that's what the legislature and the governor's office is hearing, and I think that's why we're seeing finally some traction in this area and the need that this is a top priority for not just the public defender's office but for the entire criminal justice system.
Roderick, a retired circuit judge, I think really echoes what you've been saying, Kelly. He wrote in to say, $40 an hour makes it hard to find attorneys. This means that defendants may not get adequate representation. Cases take longer to resolve because of the shortage of attorneys taking these cases. We'll continue our discussion with Kelly Thompson, Wisconsin's state public defender, in just a moment. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Stay tuned. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. At $40 an hour, the rate of pay for private attorneys in Wisconsin who take on public defender cases is the lowest in the nation. That means that fewer lawyers will take these cases, particularly in more rural parts of the state. We're talking to the state's public defender about efforts to boost the pay for these attorneys, including a recent resolution in Chippewa County aimed at raising the rate to $100 an hour. If you're an attorney, what are your thoughts here? Will you or won't you take on these public defender cases? And how does money factor into that decision-making? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Kelly Thompson, Wisconsin's state public defender, is with us. Kelly, if an increase is going to happen, who's going to be paying for it? Where's the money coming from?
Well, it would be part of our budget, and it is a budget request, so it would go through the regular cycle. Through the, it would have to be part of the, what we would hope it would be part of the governor's budget, and then through the legislature. So it is, this would, this is taxpayer money, and there's no doubt about it. But we're paying on it. We're paying this already. We're, if we're not going to pay it at the state level, we're going to pay more at the county level, and we know that. And I think that's why the counties, as part of this coalition that we've been building, have been such great advocates for this and such great supporters. We're also, by not raising this rate, we are costing the system significant dollars. We're human capital, because again, as I've talked about, we have individuals not being represented, and sometimes sitting in custody or cases being delayed. That there's a systems cost to that. We have prosecutors that aren't able to prosecute the cases, judges who are not able to hear the cases because of the delays. We have individuals who cases sometimes involve victims, and those victims are waiting, waiting and waiting, because we are not able to find attorneys for individuals. Oftentimes, especially if you're up north, and I'm sure you've heard of just the issues we have with an increase in drug use, and in significant drug use in certain areas. Opioids, we've talked a lot about meth. We're hearing significant issues with meth. When individuals aren't able to get into any type of treatment or get the help that they need because we're not able to find an attorney, there's a human cost to that as well. So there's a significant cost right now by not raising this rate.
That we had a caller who couldn't stay with us who speculated or wondered whether or not the reason we haven't seen more action on this is because the people represented by public defenders tend to be poor.
It is true by definition. If you're represented by the public defender's office, you are indigent, and I would say significantly indigent or significantly poor. And you know, there's, I know that's an issue that we hear in an argument that we don't have a group that's able to go up to the Capitol, perhaps, and talk on this issue. They're poor. They've been charged with a crime. We don't seem to see that as an argument. People seem to be pretty responsive. We have a strong public defense system. We're really fortunate in Wisconsin to have a strong criminal justice system. This is just one of those issues that I think it has not risen up to the priority level. Wisconsin has been on the forefront with a lot of, I would say, more progressive programming with treatment alternatives and diversion programs, TAD money to provide treatment for clients and oftentimes indigent clients. But there is no doubt that individuals charged with crimes are not oftentimes a focus at the Capitol. But that's my role, is to make sure that they are a focus. And I don't get much pushback on that. I think it's just making sure this is, people realize, and I hate to use this word, but we're at the point now that this has become a crisis, and we've not been able to say that. We've been able to say it's a problem, it's a significant problem, it's something that needs to be fixed. You know, it's been pushed down the line, but we're at a crisis level, and I think there are others saying that as well.
We're just about out of time here, Kelly. Do you think that your budget recommendation is going to make it into the governor's budget for this coming year, whoever the governor ends up being?
I'm cautiously optimistic. We have gotten a lot of good feedback. We've gotten a lot of people talking about it. And I think because the people talking about it, I think we've built a strong coalition that have included judges, that have included the county's association, and they are such a strong partner because people want to know what's going on at their local level, and prosecutors. We've gotten a good group of people talking about this.
Okay, good. Kelly Thompson, thanks for joining us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Kelly Thompson is Wisconsin's state public defender. With President Trump in the White House and a new lawsuit winding its way through the courts, there's a very real chance the Affordable Care Act could be repealed. In our ongoing series about how health care is playing out in this year's election campaigns, Shemaine Mills has this story on what Republicans say should replace the ACA.
Arlen Kettlebaiter of Cross Plains knows the Affordable Care Act better than most. Kettlebaiter retired just 6 months shy of his 65th birthday, the age when he would qualify for Medicare. He bought insurance on the Affordable Care Act marketplace, but it was expensive.
we had even thought about skipping insurance for 6 months. I've always been in pretty good health and all that kind of stuff. 2 months after I retired, I had cancer.
Kittlebader had lymphoma, and the doctors treated it aggressively. He underwent chemotherapy, went into cardiac arrest, and spent a week in intensive care.
On life support, breathing tube and all that kind of stuff, they told Lori that my chances of coming out of it okay were 20%.
The medical ordeal was emotionally trying and potentially financially devastating. He was in the hospital for 40 days and rehab for 20. Kettlebader says his medical expenses were close to $1 million. Insurance, bought on the ACA marketplace, covered much of it.
We were able to get Obamacare, and at that point, it was kind of like a matter of life and death.
Stories like Kettlebader's are part of the reason that getting rid of the Affordable Care Act is no easy task. Despite all its difficulties, for many people, the law is better than the health care system it replaced. The flip side is that health care premiums for most people have gone up under the ACA. Republicans have hammered this home, and over the past year, they've taken steps to address it. At the federal level, President Donald Trump signed an executive order to expand so-called association and short-term health plans.
In so many ways, change aimed at creating more and lower prices for millions of Americans.
But Trump's short-term plans don't cover much because they don't have to. They're not even considered insurance under the ACA. They were meant to be temporary, used by people in between jobs. If Obamacare goes away, Republicans say they'd bring back a health care option known as high-risk pools. These were often the only option for people with expensive medical problems before the ACA. Republican U.S. Senate candidate Leah Vukmir says they worked before and they could work again.
I support protecting people with pre-existing conditions. We did it here in Wisconsin before it was even part of Obamacare. I support bringing health care decision-making back to the states.
Wisconsin had a high-risk pool until 2014 that was touted as a national model, but it had high premiums and a lifetime limit on benefits that worried cancer groups. Going back to that system could be especially difficult now, says Nancy Wenzel, the CEO of the Wisconsin Association of Health Plans. That's because more people have pre-existing conditions today compared to when Wisconsin's high-risk pool went away.
If we're talking about the population today, it's 10 times that amount. So we can't just plug and play a solution of the past.
The numbers bear that out. Wisconsin's high-risk pool covered 22,000 people at its peak. Today, 200,000 Wisconsin residents use the ACA's private marketplace. It means most of those people will be left with more questions than answers if the law goes away. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The conversation continues here tomorrow at this time when Shemaine explains another way healthcare factors into the midterm election. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to this program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stick around. There's more to come.